Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Afghanistan has a president and a chief executive elect, two different people, and fighting in Turkey as the border closes to Syria. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Afghanistan's Independent Election Commission has named former Finance Minister Ashraf Ghani as the country's president-elect, but not released the final vote counts. The announcement today ended weeks of political bickering after a June presidential runoff election finished by Mr. Ghani and Abdullah today agreeing to form a national unity government. Their agreement makes Mr. Ghani president and gives Mr. Abdullah a new executive position to collaborate closely in governing the country. The two men will replace outgoing Afghan President Hamid Karzai in power since late 2001. And in Turkey, the borders are closing there to Syrians. The reason for that? Fighting after a massive influx of Kurdish refugees fleeing the juggernaut of Islamic State militants. Edward Duranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Turkish security forces fired tear gas at clusters of Syrian Kurdish refugees trying to cross into Turkey. Witnesses say Turkish authorities closed their border with Syria after tens of thousands of refugees entered since Friday. Arab media reports that Islamic State militants have seized 64 Kurdish towns and villages in a major onslaught during the past several days. UN officials say 100,000 Kurdish refugees have entered Turkey. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Syria's parliamentary speaker told lawmakers Sunday Western nations are responsible. This is VOA News. Officials in Sierra Leone say a group of young people attacked health workers trying to bury bodies of Ebola victims near the capital of Freetown. The confrontation occurred Saturday, the second day of a government-imposed lockdown aimed at curbing the spread of the virus that has killed more than 2,600 people in West Africa. The attackers dispersed after police reinforcements arrived to protect the burial team. Ebola has infected more than 5,300 people, most of them in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. It has also affected people in Nigeria and Senegal. Egyptian security officials say a bomb blast in downtown Cairo near the foreign ministry has killed two police lieutenant colonels. Authorities say several other police officers were wounded in the explosion that targeted a police checkpoint today. There's been no claim of responsibility. NATO's top commander says he is hopeful this weekend agreement to create a buffer zone between Ukrainian government troops and Russian separatists will calm the conflict. But he said right now, the situation is not good. Russian troops are still inside Ukraine. Speaking to reporters in Lithuania today after a meeting with NATO military chiefs, U.S. Air Force General Philip Breedlove said the ceasefire signed earlier this month is in name only.
Nine, eight, seven, six, five.
A SpaceX cargo rocket is taking its fifth shipment to the International Space Station. The unmanned rocket launched from the southeastern state of Florida today, carrying thousands of pounds of supplies for NASA, including a first 3D printer to be used by the astronauts. The cargo ship should arrive at the space station on Tuesday. The world's most powerful central bankers and finance ministers, including the U.S. Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen and International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde, are meeting in Northern Australia. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Finance ministers and central bank governors from the G20 group of nations meeting in Cairns have agreed on measures to raise global economic growth by nearly 2% over 5 years. The delegates announced a global infrastructure initiative to increase private investment. Australia, the host of the finance summit, says a global approach is needed to ensure that companies pay tax where they earn money. Following the two-day summit, Australian Treasurer Joe Hockey said while the world economy has been recovering, growth has been uneven. US counterpart Jack Lew said the strength of the US economy is having a positive effect globally, but noted with disappointment sluggish growth in Japan and in the Eurozone. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
New data shows the Earth recorded its warmest ever temperature for the June to August period. The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says the worldwide average temperature for the three-month period, 16.4 degrees Celsius. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Well, I must tell you that the 3-day house-to-house sensitization exercise or house-to-house Ebola talk has overall been successful. Despite the initial hiccups that we had at the beginning of the exercise,
Sierra Leone's 3-day Ebola disease containment measure ends on Monday.
That means there will be no any other candidate that will contest the primaries with President Goodluck Jonathan. This is a good omen for the politics of Nigeria.
Nigeria's ruling party endorses incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan for re-election.
Non-governmental organizations say underage prostitution in Korogosho accounts for 40% of the area's sex trade, and the young girls are the most vulnerable to sexually transmitted diseases.
And a group steps up efforts to end prostitution among Kenyan young girls. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sierra Leone's 3-day Ebola disease containment effort, scheduled to end on Monday, has been a success, according to Stephen Gaijia. He is the operations coordinator for the country's Operations Emergency Center. Gaijia says as part of the beefed-up operation to fight the disease, a police training school has been turned into an isolation unit to serve as both a holding and treatment center with about 120 beds. He told me earlier that the goal of the Ebola containment campaign was to reach an estimated 1.5 million households across the country.
Well, I must tell you that the 3-day house-to-house sensitization exercise or house-to-house Ebola talk, as we named it, has overall been successful. Despite the initial hiccups that we had at the beginning of the exercise on Friday, the program has worked really well. To start with, the exercise has actually been able to fast-track the response effort. The police training school, which was never on our radar screen, has now become what we call both a holding center and a treatment center. Holding in the sense that it's an isolation center with 120 beds.
Were you able to meet the target of 1.5 million people that you set?
The reports I see coming in from the different areas, but I can assure you that just taking into consideration the number of bars of soap that were dropped in the different areas, that the effort was very successful in reaching quite a good number of people. It is possible that maybe one or two houses around in different areas, in different communities, may not have been visited in a way, but we feel very comfortable that anywhere between 90 to 100% of some of the targeted households were actually reached. That is why we are even thinking that Monday, what we can do if they change some of the areas that they have not been able to actually cover, they can reach them. Not necessarily as a sit-at-home exercise, but to just make sure that the effort is consolidated and we are able to capture an accurate picture of the entire effort that we just put in place over the last 3 days.
How confident are you that with this 3-day exercise of containment measure and education, it will sharply reduce the infection rate in Sierra Leone?
What we are saying that this exercise was not in any way intended to be a foolproof. It was not intended to be the end of Ebola in Sierra Leone. It was not intended to say that it will completely break the chain of transmission in any way, by any means. What we have done was to think outside the box. If we have been able to get very close to 200 people in the different areas who came forward to either be tested, and maybe 50% of them testing positive in a way, that is a huge success story. It's another effort of actually being able to identify some of the people who have been infected, possible suspected cases, bring them to holding centers, get them tested, and take them to treatment centers within the shortest possible time. I feel very confident that it was an exercise worth doing, and it has yielded, as far as we're concerned, some very positive results. Because cases that otherwise we would not have heard about were actually immediately being identified at the community level, and the people calling our hotline of 117 and getting ambulances to go and pick up their worst people. You can imagine that the number of calls to 117 during this exercise significantly increased. On the first day, we had about 886 calls. That's almost around the neighborhood of 900. On the second day, we had very close to 1,500 calls coming in. And, you know, we are yet to look at the data. But when you put all of those things together, it tells you that this has been a very huge step in the response effort.
Stephen Guy, GRS Operations Coordinator for Sierra Leone's Operations Emergency Center. He was speaking from the capital, Freetown. And the United States Ambassador to Zimbabwe, Bruce Walton, says his country is continuously reviewing the situation in Zimbabwe as it seeks ways to improve relations between the two countries. He said relations will improve with the change of conditions on the ground in Zimbabwe. Correspondent Tara Shava has more.
Speaking to journalists at the Nalitali Monument in Shangani, Ambassador Walton said regular high-level meetings between his embassy and some government officials are being held as they seek ways to review relations between Washington and Harare. Relations between Zimbabwe and the United States have been frosty following America's imposition of targeted sanctions on President Robert Mugabe, some senior ZANU-PF members, and some state-owned companies, citing human rights abuses and alleged electoral fraud. Mr. Mugabe has consistently blamed Zimbabwe's economic problems on the sanctions. Europe, New Zealand, Australia and Canada also imposed the so-called targeted measures on Harare following the 2002 disputed elections. Ambassador Walton said his embassy closely monitors the Zimbabwean situation in order to advise Washington on how it should act regarding Zimbabwe-US relations. The U.S. this year renewed the targeted sanctions, saying not much has changed on the ground for them to lift the measures. The ambassador disagreed with the view that the targeted sanctions are hurting the ordinary people more than the targeted politicians, asserting that Zimbabwe's poor policies are to blame.
We are always looking to make sure that people in Washington understand the situation on the ground in Zimbabwe and that our policies are adjusted accordingly. We have in the last 6 months made some changes, in my view, positive changes to our sanctions list. I think that the primary challenges to Zimbabwe's economy are based in Zimbabwe's own policies.
Ambassador Walton had visited Nalitali Monument about 80 kilometers southwest of Gweru in Shangani. The monument is being restored following a $64,000 grant from the U.S. Embassy to the National Museums and Monuments of Zimbabwe. The grant was availed through the ambassador's fund. Ambassador Walton described the restoration work as an example of a genuine partnership between the U.S. and Zimbabwe, saying such development serves Zimbabwe's interests.
It serves Zimbabwe's interests in terms of preserving culture, honoring the past, respecting the depth of this country's history, and I hope that it will increase tourism, because I see a tight link between tourism and economic development here. Minister Mzembe and I have met several times. We have a very cordial relationship. We see things in similar terms, and we're determined to work together to improve opportunities for American tourists in Zimbabwe and to improve the benefits of tourism to the people of Zimbabwe.
The monument is a tourist attraction. Walton said while Zimbabwe competes with other countries for tourists, it has a lot of unique attributes, including a proud, welcoming people and beautiful natural attractions that put it in a good position to attract more tourists. The restoration of Nalitali is being done by the National Museums and Monuments of Zimbabwe in collaboration with students from the Midland State University and the University of Zimbabwe. Nyasha Gurira, a master's student in cultural heritage studies at the MSU, said the restoration not only helps students like her, but would benefit the nation at large as it preserves the national heritage. Nalitali is the country's third national monument after the Victoria Falls and the Great Zimbabwe. The monument, built in the dry stone wall style of what is known in archaeology as the Zimbabwe tradition, was, like most similar monuments around the country, constructed by the Torwa and the Rori, who are the forefathers of the Shona. Tourism Deputy Minister Epmakas Kananga and Zimbabwe Tourism Authority Chief Executive Kariko Gakaseke, who accompanied the ambassador on his visit, both thanked the U.S. government for sponsoring the restoration of the monument. Reporting from Naletale in Shangani, this is Taurai Shaba.
Prominent members of Nigeria's ruling People's Democratic Party, or PDP, unanimously endorsed incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan to be the group's candidate in February's presidential election. This, according to Senator Walid Jibrin, secretary of the party's board of trustees. With no apparent challenger from the ruling party, the endorsement effectively paves the way for Jonathan to seek a second four-year term of office. Although widely expected to seek re-election, he has yet to publicly declare his intention to do so. Jibrin told me earlier that it is not likely President Jonathan will turn down endorsement to represent the ruling PDP in next year's election.
It is true that the National Executive Council of the party has decided to choose President Goodluck Jonathan as the presidential candidate of the party comes the primary in November. And it is not only the National Executive Council that took that decision. Earlier, the Board of Trustees of the party took similar decision. The Governors Forum of Nigeria decided to, the PDP Governors Forum has decided to take that decision. The Senate, the caucus, PDP caucus of the Senate has taken the same position. The women in Nigeria have taken the same position. And so that position stands. That means there will be no any other candidate that will contest the primaries with President Goodluck Jonathan. This is a good omen for the politics of Nigeria. It is a good omen for the democracy, for Nigeria. This will reduce a lot of costs and wrangling in going about the elections. We'll be able to save more money to face the opposition in the coming election. And this election is unanimous. It will reduce rancors, wranglings, and fighting among ourselves, since other contestants who are within the system that have taken this decision will never, you know, be party to it again. So I congratulate all of us. I congratulate NEC for boldly taking the decision.
Does that mean that there will not be any challenger in the party to challenge Goodluck Jonathan during the primaries for next year's election for the party?
These key bodies are the decision makers of the party as per the constitution. If these decision makers have decided to pass this resolution and all accept this resolution, then what makes anybody to go and contest an election? Now, even if somebody comes to contest an election with this unanimous decision, I think the party is only wasting his time, because a decision has been taken by the highest bodies that are supposed to do so. And we are only talking about our primaries, PDP primaries. We are not talking about the general election in this country. We are talking about our primaries during the convention. We are going there. We are still, all of us are still going to vote and take our count of our votes for the president. But that's not to say that somebody will come to contest with him. It is himself alone that the various organs of the body, and many organs are coming again to endorse the president. This one is the highest, but there are like the chairman of all the states will come and pass their own. The all the world chairmen, all the former councillors, and others are planning to do the same thing. So who is going to contest again when Mr. President will do the decision?
President Jonathan has yet to officially say that he is running for a second full-year term. Does this endorsement basically pave the way for him to officially make the announcement that indeed he's seeking a second term in office?
Whether he announces that he's going to contest or he doesn't, we have already made him our candidate, and he has said he's overwhelmed by this decision. He thanked us for taking this decision. And so what is the message again for him to go and say he will not contest this election? I'm sure he will not disappoint these august bodies that have decided to endorse him. He will never disappoint them.
Senator Waleed Jibrin is secretary of Nigeria's ruling PDP's Board of Trustees. He was speaking from the capital, Abuja. In South Sudan's Warab state, civil servants have welcomed the decision by officials to extend the policy called Fridays as Farming Days. The day was originally supposed to run from April until August, but the authorities extended it when they realized that many crops were still in the fields. Santino Manut Ayuel reports from the state capital, Kwajok.
Warab State Agriculture Minister Mijong Bolku says officials decided to reinstate Fridays as farming days almost as soon as they expired. They did so because many crops on small farms were ready for harvest, but the people who planted them did not have the time to gather them from the fields because they work other jobs.
People have cultivated and their crops are not yet out from the field, especially groundnuts and even the sorghum and some other crops. So we said let Friday be there, and then also we said if Friday is taken out, then our policy of cultivating the short variety, which is sorghum, Gadam Hamam, would also not get time for them to do it.
Makwanya Court works as civil servant for Warab State government most days of the week. Some of the groundnuts and sorghum that he planted on his farm 5 months ago are drying in the sun after being harvested. Parts of the small piece of land on the outskirts of Kwajok, where Akot palms are covered with dark green chart variety sorghum. Akot planted the crop a month ago. Usually, everything would have been harvested by now. But this year, Akot says rain came earlier in Kwajok, and he was able to plant the short variety sorghum after he harvested the past load. But some people in other parts of Warab State had to sow late because the rains came later than usual in their areas. He says government's announcement that it was reinstating Fridays as farming day will benefit him and people who planted late.
It is going to help those who did not cultivate it earlier, because in some part like Twitch County, cultivated very late. And for those who have got a problem of blood, for example, Toyn North and even some part of Toyn East, it is going to help them.
In Warab, the rains usually come in April, but serious farming starts in May. The state government is pushing people to grow short variety sorghum because they say it thrives even without rain. The Nkolnyan also works as civil servant. He says decision to extend the day off for farming means civil servant will be less dependent on their government salaries. He says it will also help the state government's efforts to eradicate poverty through farming.
What the government is doing and what the civil servants are doing outside also, it is part of help to the government. If you devolve yourself to have a small farm, then you assist government.
Adil Mijok works most days at the State Ministry of Information and turns to small field in a spare time. She says that when the government suspended Fridays as farming days, she wondered what would happen with the crop of groundnuts that was still in her field. Without Friday farming days, she would not have time to harvest her crop, which she mainly uses to feed her family. She hopes that the policy will be continued for years to come.
Leaders come and leaders go. So I wish another leader can also do it like that some years to come, so that every Friday can be given to any official so that he can go and cultivate and also prepare his garden.
The state agricultural minister says that now farming days was being reinstated. People who still have crops in the field should use their Fridays wisely. He says the day helps people to be self-sufficient and to make some extra cash by selling their crops in the market. For BOA News, I'm Santino Manuta Yuel in Kwajok, Warao State.
There is a growing problem in a Nairobi slum in Kenya. Underage girls as young as 15 years of age are turning to prostitution to make a living. But an organization that rescues child sex workers says it's achieving positive results. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
This is the Korogosho slum in Kenya's capital. Some 200,000 people live in Korogosho, and most here eke out a living by working in industries nearby. But for others, the choice is tougher. 19-year-old Susan Muthoni became a prostitute at 16. Her parents died when she was just 10 years old, and the relatives who took her in mistreated her. She says she escaped to the streets only to find more despair.
There's the harsh weather to contend with, especially the cold. Plus, the money that clients pay is too little. I have to take care of my body, and there are those customers who prefer not to wear condoms. Also, some beat you and refuse to pay. I would like to stop what I'm doing if I get a place where they can advance me some money to start a business.
Non-governmental organizations say underage prostitution in Korogosho accounts for 40% of the area's sex trade, and the young girls are the most vulnerable to sexually transmitted diseases. Kenya's Ministry of Health says 12% of people living with HIV are children 15 and under. A group called the Miscorch Initiative is working to change this. It was formed in 2001 to stop the high incidence of rape in the slum.
They basically started it to curb the rape cases that were rampant and to sensitize girls to stand up for their rights.
Coordinator Rukia Nyambura says empowering girls is the best way to combat the sexual exploitation. Through mentoring, she says Miss Koch has successfully helped 15 girls leave the life of prostitution, and these girls now counsel others on how to avoid returning to the streets. 25-year-old Linda Morgan is one of the success stories. She says Miss Koch helped her acquire the skills to make money so she could quit prostitution.
After I've gone through their sessions and their trainings, I was in a position at least to change and be able to, like, communicate, be aggressive, and also to be confident in myself. I know that after streets there is something else better to do that you can sustain yourself and have a better livelihood.
Morgan and others make handbags, sandals, and necklaces, which are sold at exhibitions and trade fairs. They make about $1,000 a month, which provides both an income and money to invest in raw materials. Some of the money is also used for training. They have set up a computer lab and offer courses to slum residents for a small fee. The Miss Koch Initiative has plans to reach out to even more young women and girls to help them get a new start on a life with hope and dignity. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, September 21st. The race to the final of the 2014 edition of Africa's two club football competitions, the CAF Champions League and the CAF Confederation Cup, begins this weekend with first-leg semi-final matches. For the Champions League, the quartet in contention for places in the last two are AS Vita and TP Mazembe, both of the Democratic Republic of Congo, ES Setif of Algeria, and CS Faxien of Tunisia. With the exception of CS Faxien, the other three clubs have at least once laid their hands on the Premier Continental Club Football Trophy. In a match played on Saturday in the Champions League, striker Abdelmalek Ziaya scored a late winner as ES Setif bounced back to beat TP Mazembe 2-1 in Setif. The 30-year-old Ziaya, who rejoined the Algerian club a few months ago, netted the vital strike a minute from time to give his side a slim advantage ahead of the second leg next weekend in Lubumbashi. Earlier, Sofiane Yunis restored parity for the Algerians after defender Said Arousi's own goal gave the visitors the lead in the second half. Despite playing behind closed doors, Setif came back strongly to snatch victory and keep alive the hopes of its first continental silverware since 1988. The result ensured that Setif remains unbeaten in this year's campaign. The second leg will take place next week. Turning to the CAF Confederation Cup, Egyptian giant Al Ahly snatched a long goal victory away to a cutting spot of Cameroon in their first leg semi-final clash on Saturday in Garoua. Midfielder Walid Suleiman scored the goal on 72 minutes, handing the Red Devils a slim advantage ahead of the second leg next weekend in Cairo. Al Ahly, which is seeking to become the first Egyptian club to lay hands on the title, paraded a side depleted by injuries to several key players. Let's remind our listeners that Al Ahly beat Cotton Sport at the same stage of the CAF Champions League last year. The winner of the two-leg semi-final will face either Suez Sport of Ivory Coast or AC Leopards of Congo in the final, slated for November and December. Staying with African football news, Cameroon, Ivory Coast and Guinea were named future hosts of the Africa Cup of Nations by the Confederation of African Football, CAF, on Saturday. The CAF Executive Committee voted at its meeting in Addis Ababa, the Ethiopian capital, to award Cameroon the 2019 finals and Ivory Coast the 2021 edition. In an unscheduled announcement, CAF also decided to hand Guinea the right to host the 2023 finals. The Guinea announcement was unexpected, since only the hosts for the 2019 and 2021 tournaments were expected to be named. Algeria and Zambia lost out in the bidding process. The Democratic Republic of Congo had withdrawn from the race 2 months ago. Morocco will host the 2015 Cup of Nations tournament next January and February, but the host for 2017 remains undecided. Libya was picked to host the 2013 tournament, then swapped with South Africa, with the intention of hosting the 2017 instead. Libya officially withdrew last month due to ongoing security concerns, and interested countries now have until September 30th to place bids to host in 2017. The winning country will be announced next year. In a related development, the ban on Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone from hosting any international football because of Ebola fears were kept in place by CAF, according to the executive committee. The three West African countries are at the epicenter of the outbreak of the highly contagious disease. The countries had originally been banned from hosting all games until mid-September, but that ban has now been extended indefinitely. It means Guinea and Sierra Leone must again move scheduled African Nations Cup qualifiers to alternate venues next month. Guinea had to play its opening group game against Togo in Morocco earlier this month, And also last weekend staged an under-17 qualifier tie in Casablanca. Sierra Leone could not find an alternate venue for its qualifier against the Democratic Republic of Congo 10 days ago, and instead ceded home advantage to its opponents. Liberia has no scheduled international matches in the near future. Ebola has infected over 5,000 people in West Africa this year, mainly in Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia, killing just a little short of 3,000 people. The disease has also been reported in Nigeria and Senegal, but these two countries have not been banned from holding games by CAF, apparently because the spread has not reached epidemic proportions. Also, the CAF Executive Committee announced that a new fair play prize will be given to countries showing good sportsmanship. The prize will be named after Cameroonian striker Albert Ebosse, who died last month after his Algerian club GS Kabylie suffered a 2-1 home loss in a National League match. Ebosse was hit after an angry fan threw a piece of slate as the players were leaving the pitch, and he died of head injuries in a nearby hospital. CAF hopes the fair play prize, which will come with a monetary award yet to be determined, will preserve Ebosse's legacy. In addition, CAF's executive committee decided to launch a campaign to say no to violence in African football. Finally, from the CAF executive committee, Africa will support Sepp Blatter in next year's election for the presidency of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA. This is a symbolic boost for the 78-year-old Swiss incumbent, who announced this month he will be standing for a fifth term. Blatter had previously promised to retire at the end of his current term. The committee's decision is not binding on the 54 members of CAF, who have previously defied CAF president Issa Hayatou. But Blatter is popular among African football officials, most notably for bringing the World Cup to the continent for the first time in 2010, when South Africa played host. So far, Blatter has no official challenger for next year's election. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks a lot. Segun will be back again next Sunday for another look at Africa Sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Well, it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time for music from the continent. Relax and enjoy.
Oh, It's that Lumba say, unsaid, unsaid, unsaid. Oh, don't you mean you way, he say, yeah. Coo, coo. Dear, so be don't be an ill be a new quack. Show you, ah, who's so crying on me, oh, ha. Coo, coo. I deemed your baby, and I'm not me tissue, ha, ha. Dummy chip, dummy dick, ha. See me new pretty, ah, ya. But don't my grandma, India, Indiana. Oh, did I want you, sir? So, and now see me ding, see me ding, daddy, eh. Why did he ask his ah? And go on, quam, quam, kaya, say, sir. And so, only a girl who said, oh, then you're me a shrug for the year. Me name, not a day. Me name, what's the word of the town for the year? To me, say, oh, 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 ain't it? Me say, don't be a simo. When you mean to me, say, don't my bro boy mo. When you mean any high, me say, don't. You mean to me, say, don't my bro boy mo. Ah, when you mean any high, whoa, whoa, whoa. Hurry, someday out of the way. That you look, see.
It's a
Crossing there to share. Yeah, the BS is your man, so Rosu. Was to bend your dapper for them now. Ah, yeah, 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 yeah. That's so true. Boom, okay. Some kind of full and let. Hey, yo, so warm affair. Same way, Bruni, where we suck, why you know? Bring for me in Pomo. Oh, Baba, yeah, your name, what he ain't he will come, woman, take your lossy. Hey, no, can I so you call up? Wow, warrior, yeah, yeah, governor.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed it from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa. Wama's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. At long last, the international community showed signs of meeting the challenges of the tragedies of the Ebola crisis. Even though some critics have bemoaned the fact that the response has been very slow, it is better to be late than never. First off the block was the government of Cuba, which decided to send about 165 health personnel to assist Sierra Leone. The United Kingdom followed with a commitment to erect a 50-bed medical facilities in Sierra Leone to help contain the crisis. Next to follow was France, which promised to send medical assistance to Guinea, a major move given the tumultuous relationship between the two countries. The most intriguing was the surprising decision announced by President Barack Obama to send a force of 3,000 to Liberia to assist with the containment of the Ebola crisis. Some critics and cynics have wondered whether troops were the appropriate instruments to tackle the Ebola crisis. President Obama later explained that his response to Liberia was at the request of its president, Mrs. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Indeed, the president of Liberia made a key speech in which she confirmed that she had approached U.S. and congressional leaders for assistance. However, it might be useful to give further explanation as to why troops are being sent. There are those who have questioned whether the whole exercise is a form of regime protection or the initial building block of what was referred to previously as U.S. African Command in Africa. Given the fact that at that time when it was first announced under the Bush administration, the president of Liberia was the first to request that the troops have their headquarters in Liberia. The next to follow was the Security Council. And the U.S., as the current president of the Council for the month of September, called an emergency meeting to discuss the Ebola crisis. Stretching the limits of the United Nations Charter, the Security Council, which has the charter mandate to deal with breach of the peace, threat to the peace, and act of aggression, concluded that the Ebola crisis was a threat to the international community. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, also played a part when he decided to form a panel to help coordinate the international assistance on the Ebola crisis. This move will help to ensure that the appropriate assistance are sent to the right place. However, the African states concerned, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, have been playing their own part during the course of last week. The most spectacular and somewhat controversial was the decision of the government of Sierra Leone to install what was called, quote-unquote, a lockdown of the 6 million people for 3 days, beginning on Friday, ending on Sunday. There are some Sierra Leoneans who wonder whether this could achieve its purpose, but the representatives of the WHO in Sierra Leone came on the air to say that the exercise was useful because it would assist the government to carry out a campaign on Ebola education and possibly to identify any new victim on the Ebola crisis. Now, the sad thing is that despite all this international mobilization of efforts, that it will become worse before it becomes better, given the fact that it takes 21 days to become fully infected. And this may be a real problem for these countries. But by and large, there are bright prospects ahead. With these concerted efforts on all sides, the prospects are clear that the world community will be able to contain the Ebola crisis within the next few months. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jonah. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. I hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor William Eagle, producer Douglas Impuga, sports editor Segun Adeyemi, and our engineer Jackson Wade, we say thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Amid almost 2 years of political turmoil and intercommunal fighting, the United States has stood with the people of the Central African Republic. This year alone, more than $145 million has been provided in humanitarian aid as we joined with international partners to help end the violence, support a national dialogue, and pave the way for a political transition culminating in an inclusive and democratically elected government. To increase our ability to support these efforts, the U.S. Embassy in Bangui is resuming operations, 21 months after it closed due to instability and violence. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry named diplomat David Brown as U.S. Chargé d'Affaires to oversee operations, noting that much work remains to be done.
On arriving in Bangui, Mr. Brown announced an additional $28 million in humanitarian assistance. With the September 15th transition from the African Union peacekeeping force to one organized by the United Nations, the United States extends its profound thanks to the AU, the nations that contributed troops and support for the effort, as well as the French and European forces for their important contributions to the region's peace and stability. We call on all parties to fully support the UN mission in its vital task ahead. Only a fully inclusive, peaceful, and democratic political transition process can stop the cycle of violence in the Central African Republic. That process must include the voices of all Central Africans, including refugees and internally displaced persons. It must end impunity, hold those who have committed abuses accountable for their actions, and give all citizens access to justice. And it must lead to free and fair elections that give all Central Africans a stake in the future of their country. The Central African Republic and its people are at a crucial juncture. The United States is determined to make this moment of opportunity a success.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.